Well, hi everybody. As they gather in, we've been doing church history. We started off with Jake talking about the persecution of the early Christian church, how it affected, how it grew. We got then into the Eastern Church and the Western Church, and today we're going to take a quick tour through the Crusades. The Crusades, you might ask, what were the Crusades? And in modern definition, they would describe the Crusades as being a religious war fought between the Christians and the Muslims over the occupation of the Holy Land. I think that is a poor description. I think a better description would be the defense of God's kingdom, His church, and His people. Through the course of preparation for this lesson, there's been a text that's been on my mind during this whole action of a few weeks. I wanted to share it with y'all before we get started with the lesson itself. And this is found in Joshua 1. And it's right after the death of Moses. And the Lord comes and He speaks to Joshua. He says, "Now therefore go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into a land that I will give them to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your feet will tread upon, I have given to you. Just as I promised to Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea towards the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their forefathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the laws of Moses that my servant has commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go." And I think this was given to Joshua as they prepared to go over and take the promised land. But as we live our lives in today's society, I think it equally belongs to us. And it's a commandment to stay true to the Lord. Turn not to the left nor to the right. And that's where we found the church had sometimes departed from and sometimes returned to. To begin with the Crusades, we need to take a look back first to the Roman Emperor Constantine that Joel had mentioned a few weeks ago. In 355, and there's some handouts back here with the timeline if you'd like to follow along. I'll follow that somewhat too. And also a map so you can see different places of interest as we cover. Well, Constantine ordered the erection of the Holy Sepulchre to be built in Jerusalem. Not only in Jerusalem, but upon the hill of the crucifix. This is vitally important as we study the Crusades because it's going to be their ultimate destination, the Holy City. It had been taken, it had been raped, it had been plundered, and now these Crusaders, as they gather together, that will be their first destination. But before we get there, why have they got to have a destination and why have they got to be a Crusade? To do that, we have to understand what we're fighting against. In 570, there was a young man born in Mecca, Arabia. His name was Muhammad. He will later become known as the Prophet Muhammad. Some historians describe Muhammad's youth as somewhat of a rebellious character, that it really doesn't matter. What matters is that one morning, he came to face his family and the community of Mecca, and he told them that he had a vision from Gabriel. And Gabriel had given him some words that he needed to carry out throughout life. And he told these people, I saw Gabriel, therefore I am a prophet. In the likeness of Moses, in the likeness of Jesus, I am a prophet. And the things that I'm about to tell you are true. You have to listen to me. Well, Mecca and the leaders, you can imagine, didn't particularly care for the assertion of this young man, and they exiled him. He was exiled to a place where he started his ministry of Medina. In Medina, like everywhere that his ministry would take place in Arab, he says, I, thank you, nice meeting you. My name is the Prophet Muhammad. I have a message from God, and I give you three choices. Either you listen to my message and accept me as a prophet, or you leave and you give me your land, or I kill you. And that had been his method of evangelism throughout Arab. And he was relatively successful at creating a following with that method. Eventually, he was strong enough to go back and approach Mecca, approach these folks that exiled him, and says, listen, look at all my followers I have now. See, I am the prophet, and you can come without any judgment and follow me if you wish to. Or you could face the alternatives. And it's that method that separates the church, really, from the Muslim religion, who both proclaim to be from the Word of God. One came with humility and persecution. The other came with assertion and brutality. Well, Muhammad dies. Before his death, he elected an individual he called a caliph to take his place in leading the movement. The first caliphate then moved into the Mediterranean basin. In the Mediterranean basin, the first territory was Syria that they approached. And the historians, several of them, will describe the method that he was using in Syria for non-compliant, non-people that would not accept him as prophet. The first one's rather graphic, but I think it's important for us to understand the brutality that we're talking about here. He says, if you did not accept him as a prophet, their navels were pierced. Their entrails were pulled out and tied to a post. They were flogged until the innards were pulled out. And then they lay on the ground and they died. We also see the brutality of women and rape going on, of which most of the historians won't even talk about. They say just the thought of it is more explicit than the details. Well, this caliph continues his conquest. He goes down and he captured Palestine the same way, Damascus, and then Jerusalem. Well, about the time he approaches Jerusalem, someone approaches him and says, listen, all of these people, or most of these people that knew Muhammad, they have been killed in battle, and there's nothing recorded. We're told that Muhammad had a companion that did some scratching on some parchments or some drawings on some rocks. But that was pretty much all that was written about Muhammad saying. The caliph said, yeah, it's important that we do something, but we're kind of busy here, and we'll get to it later. Well, he dies. What was written down was then handed to his daughter. His daughter would later approach the third caliph. Same explanation. We need to record what's going down here. That third caliph then said, well, you're right. We need to take this material over to a safe garrison of ours and store it. We need to start writing down what's going on. But in the meantime, all these other records that we have, all these duplicates, you should destroy them. You should burn them in fire. And so, they were destroyed. And we see the Quran starting an evolution from there on after the third caliph. Well, these folks continued to move on out of the Mediterranean down into North Africa, where we see them moving into the metropolis of Alexandria. Alexandria, now this is up for debate, but a lot of scholars will agree that the library of all knowledge, certainly probably one of the largest in the world at that time, containing from 4,000 to 7,000 books, two different buildings, was in Alexandria. It's reported that one of the individuals came up and he said, look, what do we do with these libraries and these books? The third caliph, he looks at him and he goes, well, if it has to do with the book, we don't need it. If it doesn't have to do with the book, we don't want it. Destroy them. Burn them. Well, while they were in Alexandria, their vision started expanding. Now confident after conquering all the Mediterranean seacoasts that they wanted to take their empire further up into Europe and beyond. And their excitement built and their confidence built, and they decided there was two major passages up into Europe. There was a passage down through, if we go up and through Constantinople, that's a good gateway for us. Or we can go around through Spain and the Strait of Gibraltar. Well, now you can imagine that these two families now that both wanted power started fighting, and we see a schism take place. We see a separation between the Shiites and the Sunnis. The Sunnis would eventually find themselves up in Persia, while the Shemites would stay in the lower part of the country. But this idea of Europe was on both their minds. In Alexandria, there was a shipyard. There was a commissioning of ships. They built and they sailed up to Constantinople. They hired mercenary sailors. They hired captains from foreign countries, and they sailed their vessels up into the harbor of Constantinople, which was fairly securely protected by a large chain that was stretched across the harbor preventing ships to get in. Well, that chain had been lowered. The ships came into the harbor, and they were hit face to face with what I'm calling the first divine intervention of God. It was an invention called Greek fire. It was a concoction of chemicals that once ignited, it would burn and it couldn't be extinguished. When it came into contact with water, it even burned hotter. Well, they catapulted and got this stuff on board these ships that was in the harbor. The ships burnt. The army was destroyed. Word gets back then to the third caliph that method didn't work. So they route another army, maybe 40,000 soldiers, to go up through Spain. They get up in Spain and they conquered Lower Spain with relative ease. And they were confident that this was going on. Meanwhile, they began killing individuals that other individuals knew. Amongst them was a king up north in Europe. He had a son, an illegitimate son, named Charles the Hammer Martel. He explained to Charles that we have the invasion and the threat of the church coming into Europe by these Muslims. They have to be stopped. Well, Charles assembled an army, a small army, maybe 1,500 or so, went down to meet these folks in Spain. It's estimated there was 40 to 60,000 people in the Muslim army, and the Hammer might have taken 1,500. They met up on a ridge in a territory called Tours. Well, Charles got there and he prepared for battle. He set his soldiers up on the high ground, shield for shield, lance for lance, sword in hand. The Muslims approached them, looking up on the hill. They never saw such a thing, but confident because of all the successful battles that they'd had, they charged him. Many were killed, but they charged him again and again and again. Then some soldiers within the army decided, hey, these Christians have snuck around the back of us and they're stealing our loot wagon, and we need to go protect the loot wagon. And so they split off and they run back. Their running back to the loot wagon was perceived as being a retreat, and the rest of the army turned back and headed back for the loot wagon. In the meantime, Charles let his cavalry go on their big German horses or their big European horses, the high back saddles, the lances at hand, and they took care of that army. The rest of the Muslims in Spain would later be dispatched by the Hammer's grandson, Charlemagne. So, advance a few years, we see that the Sunnis that had split off with the Shiites had now established their kingdom up in Persia. They became known as the Seljuk Turks. And they began capturing territory, first Baghdad and Armenia. And then they went into Jerusalem, and the story of their persecution, oppression of the Christians and the Jews was much more severe than the original occupation, and they were destroying relics, and it was becoming an issue. But they weren't happy there. Syria and Palestine and then Antioch got the attention of the emperor, the Byzantine emperor. And he found that he was kind of between a rock and a hard place. He says, these folks are likely, they're within 120 miles of Constantinople, they're likely to come in here and wipe this city, this empire out. If they were to do so, it will also open the gates and allow the Muslims to infiltrate Europe. It was a bad situation. He writes this letter to Pope Urban, a new pope now, Pope Urban II, pleading for help from the European churches. He says, can you help us because we're in dire straits? Well, the pope looked at it probably and he thought, well, first of all, let's look at why I think I'll be successful at convincing these people they should follow. The pilgrimage. If you recall, the church was built in, the Holy Sepulchre was built in Jerusalem. That became an important destination for the act of devotion. It was a formal expiation of sins for much of these Catholic population of Rome's. It was just prescribed by the confessors that if you want to be admitted into heaven, you need to make this pilgrimage expeditions now were blocked. They were impeded. They were no longer available for the common people. For a group in Europe, this became especially important because they viewed the times as the end times. They viewed Jerusalem as being an earthly representation of the holy city that Christ is sure to return to. And they had to be there. They couldn't be there. So Pope was thinking, this is certainly enough ammunition, but there was something else going on within the church too, and it was a preaching of peace. These warriors that had been wandering around Europe defending their lands have now been warned to stop, at least on particular days of the week, don't fight anymore. And if you must fight, then the truce of God must be held. It must be to protect the lives of the clergy, to protect the travelers, to protect the women and the cattle, and even to protect your neighbors. If they can't defend themselves, then you can defend. And if that kind of stuff, that's justified. you can't get in on your pilgrimage anymore, but I rest you assured that if you join in this battle, in this God's battle, you will have admittance to heaven. God will see you as holy and just. And so his presentation was received well, overwhelmingly well, but that concerned Pope Urban. So he writes a letter to one of the communities. He says, I see that you are interested in joining the battalion. He says, you can join on this exception. This has nothing to do with earthly gain. This is only to protect God's kingdom. It's only to protect your brothers and sisters. If you agree to that, then by all means, you are welcome. And then please come. Now, this plea went out not only to the rich and the royalty, but it went out to everybody. And there was a group of peasants, poor people, common people, that was wanting to join in. Their souls were moved. They wanted to be part of this, but they had no money. They had no land to sell. And they were kind of feeling distressed. You know, I want to be part of this. I can't be accepted into the royal army, but... And then here comes this obscure pope. His name was Peter the Hermit. Peter was described as having a long face and resembled that of his donkey. People say that he smelled like a stein full of pigs. But Peter could preach. And did he preach? And he told these peasants, if you follow me, I will lead you, but I will also pay your way. And he did. He put his loot wagon in the caravan and they started off immaturely, which was unfortunate. But their pilgrimage didn't go so well. As they started their pilgrimage, their caravan was attacked. The loot wagon was stolen. These people were without provision, so that led them to stealing cattle, money, whatever they needed to survive. To make matters worse, as the journey progressed further south, they met a group of people, darker skin, different clothing, different language. That must be the enemy that we're coming against. Even though it's likely that these people were Christians, they couldn't distinguish them and they killed them. That was a bad reputation. It started off bad for the Crusades. However, they did make it all the way down to Constantinople. They were greeted by the Emperor Alexis. But Alexis says, you know, thank you for coming. We welcome you. But why don't you go over to this other territory, to this other city, and wait there for the main brigade to show up? Once they show up, you can join them and then join the forces for God's war. Well, Peter said, well, we have nothing to eat. We have no provisions. How are you going to provide for us? He says, that's not an issue, so I'll take care of you. On their way over to wait for the main battalion, they were ambushed by the Turks, completely annihilated. There may have been a couple people escape, but we told that Peter the Hermit was one that did escape, and he found his way back into Constantinople. And he would later join the brigade of the main crusade as they came. Well, eventually it was time to depart from Europe. And there were five different groups that were going to leave Europe together. They would split up and go different routes because there were so many people that was involved that the territories couldn't handle them. But they would all meet in Constantinople and get directions and be dispatched from there. One of them left via ship against the advice of others. It was late in the season, but they left and they met a storm and were shipwrecked and lost at sea. So they're out of the equation. We have a couple brothers from Belgium that came down. We had Godfrey of Bouillon and his brother Baldwin. Now, Baldwin was kind of unique of this whole bunch because he had no intent of going back home. He was wanting to set up his establishment along the Mediterranean basin. And so he brought his wife, he brought his loot, his kids, and all the things that he would need to establish his new kingdom. We have the Norseman, Bohemond. Now, Bohemond was a big, scary man. He was a head and shoulder over everyone else. Fair hair, ugly fellow. But he was a seasoned warrior, and people were scared to death of him. We have Raymond of St. Gillis. Now, probably out of all of them, he had the largest army, and he was probably the most distinguished and the more capable leader of the bunch. He was with, and then we have Robert of Flanders, who was a brother of King Williams, the King of England. But that's really the only royalty that we saw in this first crusade, the one that we'll be covering today. In May of 1990, let me backtrack a little bit. So they finally all did meet up in Constantinople. The emperor saw them gathering around. He was scared to death because now we have an organized military force. They're going to take over my land, he thought. So what can he do? He invites them in and signs a pact with them, telling them that any land that you take, you will hand back over to me at the end of this skirmish. And some of them agreed. Godfrey agreed reluctantly, and some of the other ones kind of half-heartedly agreed, and they signed this pact. After signing that, they left. First place they came to was Nicaea. Well, Nicaea saw this group coming, and they opened the gates, and they surrendered without much of anything. And that's where Baldwin, Godfrey's brother, set up camp. Now, that's where he's going to have his new kingdom and rule. Their next journey from Nicaea was to Antioch. That wasn't quite so easy. In June 19th, they left out for Antioch, and it wasn't until October that they finally showed up. Difficult march. They did fight enemies, but mostly they fought nature. Exhaustion, hydration, hypothermia. A lot of people died on this march going down to Antioch. But finally, on October, they arrived and they surrounded the city. Could not penetrate the fortress. So they sat the perimeter of Antioch for about 8 months. Ran out of food, nearly dying of starvation. They were demoralized. Meanwhile, in the interwalls of Antioch, pigeons were released, and they were sent out to summons for help. Well, that was received, and help was dispatched. A couple scouts, or some scouts from the Crusaders, reported that there was a giant army approaching from the rears. These people were tired. They're starved, they're weak, they felt there wasn't any hope now, and a lot of them left. Amongst them that left, guess what? Peter the Hermit was one of them. Well, on their retreat back to Constantinople, here comes the Emperor Alexis. He sees Peter, he asks how it's going. He says, Peter told me it's a hopeless cause. These people, we have lost it. There's no hope for him. So this dude turns around and he heads back home. Didn't even show up. That was the reinforcements they were counting on. But Bowman somehow, miraculously, makes contact with the commander within the city of Antioch. He sympathized to the group and he let them in the back door. They came in, they sacked the city, only to find themselves now the captor. They look over the wall, and here's this giant army surrounding the city. It was hopeless before, but at least they could run away. Now they were locked in this ill-provided encampment. Already the provisions were gone because of the siege that they had just done. And that's when I say the third divine interaction happened. One of the popes, had a vision, he claimed. He took a group of people into a church. He dug into the ground, into the floor, and they pulled up a piece of iron. He holds it up and he says, this is the holy lance. The lance appears the sight of God, the sight of Jesus. They took it outside and they hung it up. The army saw it and they revitalized. They say, look at a holy relic. God is with us. Surely if God is with us, who can be against us? They thought, and they threw the gates open and they rushed this giant army that was sitting outside. The army saw these crazy people coming out the doors and they ran, they fled. They were never seen, so they captured Antioch. Well, they go back in the city now. An argument takes place between who's going to run it. And while they were arguing, the plague hits. Sickness falls on the camp, and it lasts about a year. But the people recover. Bowman takes occupation of Antioch, and they proceed to Jerusalem, where they had headed out for 3 years ago. Well, on June 7th, 1099, they set camp around the city of Jerusalem. And this is where the fourth divine interaction of God I call takes place. They needed to breach the walls of Jerusalem, but the only way they knew how to do it was scale the walls. To scale the walls, they need a tower. Certainly they need ladders, right? There's no wood. The wood had been cut down years ago. There wasn't a tree in sight anywhere. But somehow, somewhere, the wood came. God rebuilds a tower, he scales the wall, and they capture Jerusalem. 3.5 years later, after a 3,200-mile march, after watching their brothers die of starvation, of disease, of the sword, after leaving their families, these people entered Jerusalem, the holy city, their destination. Looking about the city, they could not distinguish a man from his religion. They could not distinguish a man from his complexion or of his dress. They all looked alike. Blood was shed that day, not unlike other cities that are invaded. But the blood that was shed that day would go down in history. And that's where we, as Christians, as responsible people, need to educate ourselves. Some of the modern scholars would say, New York Times, for example, in 1999 wrote an article comparing that day as a Holocaust, as genocide against humanity. 2 months after the World Trade Center fell, Bill Clinton spoke to the students at the Georgetown University saying, yeah, the Muslims, they're not all at blame. If any of you are of European descent, the blood of Godfrey is on your hands too. That's what the modern people want to teach us. Were the Crusades a just war? They went on for another 200 years as they continued to defend God's kingdom. Were they just? That's up for each of you to decide to pray about. What I would urge you to do is get your research done, go as close to the sources that you can get, and decide for yourself. Were the Crusades a just war? And that's all I have for you folks. But I'll be happy to answer any questions. A just war. So I think that the truths of God, the peace of God that was established by the early church is a good yardstick. What is right to defend and what is wrong to defend are the people that can't defend themselves worth sticking up for? Is the church, a compromise of the church, worth standing up for? Is this a chosen battle by the Lord? Prayer. I'm sorry, Jake, speak up, please. Our conflict today. We're told by society today that woman is not woman because she can bear a child. Is that true? We're told today that the early Muslim during this crusade were peaceful people. They were educated people. They were civilized, living in a utopia, welcoming others and loving on others, and to turn a blind eye to whatever they do, while Christians are wicked and hateful. As Christians, we need to continue to show love and compassion towards mankind, while at the same time defending without bending on the word of the living Lord, our God. Society is so confused. The educational system, our academic system, will tell us this was not a just war. They will tell us today that the Christians are in a fault of many, many things. But nonetheless, as I opened with that text, we're told not to turn from the right hand to the left hand, but to stand on the commandments given to Moses, his servant. And that's how we are distinguished, and that's how we are developed our walk in life. So throughout my life, I have sparked conversations with individuals, and we've talked about God. And as that conversation has progressed, time and time and time again, they go, well, how about the Crusades? What have I done? I shrugged my shoulders and I hung my head and I didn't know what to tell them. I was convinced the Crusades were a wicked thing that was done by wicked people in a wicked time that no longer exists. When I started preparing for this lesson, that was my mindset. As I got through the easy material, the material that you find online, the encyclopedias and modern authors, I was convinced that I was still right. As I started getting closer to the sources within the 1100 years, back in the 1100s and sooner, I found that the historians, I found that the Muslim religion was not necessarily as pure as I might have thought. And my mind was changed through prayer, through the text that I shared with you in Joshua, and through the research of people, eyewitnesses that I read on this research. Thank you, folks. Here you go.